The roar of freedom rejuvenates us. When we hit the next dead end, Tomas says, "Well, that's one less dead end until we find the exit." And we backtrack again. And then we hear it. The sound of boots pounding on pavement. Someone is running close by. We move faster. Turn. Pedal. Dead end. The running feet are coming nearer. I look to Tomas. Fear and determination are bright in his eyes as he nods. We both step off our bicycles, lay them down on the ground, and draw our weapons. The pounding of leather on stone is more distinctive. Right around the bend, I raise my gun, hold my breath, and force my hand to steady. I see the shadow first, the outline of a person, the outline of the gun in the person's hand. My arm muscles are taut, my finger poised over the trigger as the shadow comes closer. I know my weapon has the farthest reach. The runner could fire the minute he sees us, which means I'll have to shoot first. Without knowing the person's intentions, without knowing whether he or she means us any harm. I will my finger to press the trigger as the shadow looms larger and a figure bursts around the corner. And I fail. I can't take a life. I barely register that the person is male. All I know is that if Tomas and I die, it's my fault. Only instead of a gunshot, I hear, "See ya! Tomas? Is it really you?" Before I can understand that we aren't going to die, I am swept up by a dirty pair of arms into Will's laughing embrace. His laughter is contagious and I cling to him. My nose wrinkles at the scent of him, dirt and body odor combined with blood and whatever else he's run into since this test began. But I don't care. Face it, I'm not smelling like a rose these days, and holding him gives me hope that Xandri and Nicolette might also be alive. "It's great that you and Tomas managed to hook up with each other out here. I never thought I'd find either of you." His raised eyebrow asks to hear the story of how Tomas and I came to find each other, so I step back and say, "I had some trouble getting out of the drop-off city. Tomas arrived in time to rescue me from a swim in that river, or worse." There's no point in telling Will that Tomas and I conspired to meet. It would only highlight the fact that we didn't include our other friends in the plan. Trust is hard enough in this environment. Now that my shock has worn off, I notice a bandage on Will's shoulder caked with dried blood. "What happened to you? Are you okay?" I ask. Will flashes me a roguish smile. "I'm fine. Just a misunderstanding with a tree branch. No big deal." "Infection can be a big deal," I say, reaching into my bag. "Why don't you let me take a look?" Will shakes his head. "It's fine. Honest. Our time would be better spent getting out of this stupid maze. We have to be getting close to the end of this thing. I don't know about you, but I'm starting to run low on food and water." I'm about to insist on stopping everything to treat Will's shoulder, but Tomas speaks. "Will's right. We need to get out of here. We can deal with the rest once we find the exit. Let's hit the road." Tomas and I pick up our bicycles off the ground. We wheel them along as we walk next to Will, who's curious how we came by them. Tomas seems content to let me do the talking, so I give Will a rundown on finding the wheels and the bicycles and how we repaired them. It turns out Will found a non-motorized scooter in a garage. One of the wheels wouldn't turn, but he managed to loosen it up and rode it on the same road we traveled into this maze. I kept hitting dead ends, and I was so frustrated that I forgot to be careful. I was going down a slope a little too fast, lost control, and fell off the scooter. The next thing I knew, the scooter hit the barrier at the end of the road and blew sky high. Guess I'll have to look for another set of wheels once we're out of this place, especially if I plan on keeping up with the two of you. As we search for the exit route, Will tells us about his travels, which sound uneventful compared to ours. The water he drank from the first source made him a little queasy, but thus far he's been able to find supplies and food along the way. When he shows me a spool of wire he found, I'm ready to kiss him. It's thin and flexible and perfect for setting snares. If we ever get out of here, we might have an easier time catching food. I'm so delighted with the wire that he gives it to me to carry in my bag. As much as I want it, I shake my head. You found the wire, you should have control of it. Think of it as a thank you gift. If you hadn't stopped me from going for medical attention after the second round of tests, I wouldn't even be here. None of the candidates who went came back. Then Will leans down and whispers, "Besides, I don't know if we'll be traveling together after we get out of this city. Tomas looks pretty intent on keeping you to himself." I start to deny it, but Tomas hasn't had much to add to the conversation since Will arrived. And when he does, there is a wary quality to his tone that makes me wonder what he's thinking. At the moment, Tomas is walking in front of us, close enough to hear the conversation, but far enough away to avoid participating. I have to wonder if Will isn't correct. Not about keeping me to himself. Tomas knows this isn't the time or place for romantic drama. Survival, passing this test, has to take precedence. But maybe the fact that Will doesn't have a method of travel other than his own feet is making Tomas wary. Teaming up with Will means a much slower pace of travel than what we've set thus far. Although I don't know how well Tomas can ride with his injury. He's been limping more and more as the day goes on. If we get out of this maze, I'm hoping we can find a cool stream for him to soak in to help reduce the swelling. There's no point in worrying about Will and Tomas now. Not with another dead end looming. We backtrack, take another path. At the next fork, there are only two options, left or right. The compass says the road leading out of the city is somewhere to our right. We head in that direction. We follow the compass's direction and keep walking. It's Tomas who points out the size of the buildings that we pass. They're becoming smaller, similar to the ones we rode by when entering the city. The end of this maze must be near. I desperately want to jump on my bicycle and race down the road to see if he's right. Instead, we walk. A mile passes without a fork, without a choice to make. 2 miles. Our smiles become more confident. There are fewer and fewer buildings. Finally, there's just hard, caked earth. The plants that have been able to survive in this landscape, and the road looming long in front of us. When the city is several miles behind us, Will asks, "Do you mind if I camp with you guys tonight? I don't want to slow you down tomorrow, but it'd be nice to have company for a little while longer." "Of course you can camp with us tonight." Tomas beats me to agreement, but I notice he's careful to promise only to stay with Will for the night. While I know it might annoy Tomas, I add, "Our food stores are low. We're going to need to search for food and water tomorrow on foot. Maybe we'll find some wheels along the way. Then we can travel together to the end." "Sounds good to me," Will smiles. "But if we don't find wheels tomorrow, I don't want you and Tomas hanging back on my account. The quicker you get to the end, the better, you know?" Tomas seems to relax after that. We walk until the sun is low on the horizon. The southernmost fence line that marks the boundary of the testing area is visible from the road. Beyond it, I can see the glistening of water, clean and bright. I can't help but wonder if the sight of water is another test designed by the officials to see if we remember and follow instructions to not leave the designated testing area. We pick a spot behind a pile of large rocks to make camp. While Tomas and Will start a fire, I head off to look for food. The ground here is harder and more water-starved than on the other side of the city. But near the fence line, there are signs of healthy plant life. On the other side of the fence, I can see a lake. No doubt the reason for the health of the plants at my feet. Despite my frustration at being unable to reach the water, I'm happy to come away with several handfuls of dandelion greens, some wild onion, and a pot filled with white clover. I also put Will's wire to good use. 200 yards from our camp, I set several snares, trying to remember everything my brothers taught me about trapping animals. If I'm lucky, a wayward animal or two will cross my snares. I can only hope because my stomach is already hollow with hunger. Will's water bottle is empty. Tomas and I share our water with him during the meal. When night falls, there are just a few swallows at the bottom of one of the canteens. Finding a water source will have to be our first order of business tomorrow. Otherwise, we won't need to discuss who will travel with us. Tomas insists on setting up a watch rotation for the night. With three of us, we can each get a decent night's sleep and still have someone standing guard. Sia and I had a close call with some wild animals recently. I'd rather not repeat that experience if we don't have to. We leave the fire burning and Tomas gives me a long kiss before climbing on top of the rocks to watch over us while we sleep. I'll take last watch. In almost no time at all, Will shakes me awake and quickly sinks into sleep as I take my place on the rocks. The fire has burned down low, but it still casts enough light on my friends that I can see Tomas's shoulder muscles relax as Will begins to snore. Did Tomas stay awake during Will's watch? He must have. I'm torn between frustration at Tomas's lack of trust and guilt that I trust so easily. Seeing Tomas's uneasiness, I'm forced to reconsider my plans to have Will travel with us. Birds singing signal the arrival of dawn. I promised Tomas to wake them at first light, but I decide to forage for breakfast in order to give Tomas a few more precious minutes of sleep. The sight of a skinny but very edible rabbit caught in one of my snares makes me grin. I walk along the fence line on my way back to camp, on the lookout for other food. A handful of clover and a few wild carrots end up in my bag. I'd like it to be more, but these will have to do. I turn my back on the fence and start to hike back to Tomas and Will when I hear a twig snap. Whipping around, I draw my gun and take aim, expecting to find an animal. Instead, on the other side of the fence, I see a gray-haired man, and he's smiling at me. Chapter 16. Before I can say a word, the man throws a small bag over the fence and disappears into the brush. I stare at the bag, trying to decide if this is another test. Do I look in the bag and risk something exploding, or leave it and walk away? The sack is small and made of a coarse brown material, not anything like the fabrics used to make our Commonwealth testing bags or any of the bags I saw in the testing supply room. I think about the man who threw it. His clothes were faded but in good repair. His skin was sunbaked and weathered, but his muscles looked strong from hard use. More like my father, less like the testing officials I've come in contact with. So who is the man? One of the rebels Michael mentioned in Magistrate Owen's house? History tells us there were differing opinions about how to revitalize the country after the seventh stage of war ended. Those who survived struggled with how best to proceed. To band all the survivors together under another centralized government, or to allow each group of survivors the freedom to choose their own way forward. Those who disagreed with the choice of the majority struck out on their own. Could the man I saw be one of the survivors who live outside the United Commonwealth Authority? If so, why is he throwing a bag over the fence marked as United Commonwealth Territory for me? After several minutes, curiosity wins out. I pick up the bag, hoping to find some clue to the man's identity inside. Instead, there's a loaf of bread, a small hunk of white cheese, a bag of raisins, and a bottle of water. I open the cap to the water and sniff it. The scent is clean and pure. A few drops of my chemicals confirm it. I contemplate the items in my hands. The almost magical appearance of water when we're running so low is a blessing. So are the other supplies. But there's no way I can share them with my companions, not without provoking questions about where the food and water came from. If it was just Tomas, I could have him remove his identification bracelet. Will doesn't know about the listening devices implanted in the bracelets, and we haven't known each other long enough for me to guess how he'll react when he finds out about them. He might tip off the listeners and give away the only advantage we have. Not to mention letting the testers know we have received help from outside the fence. I can't help but wonder what the penalty for that kind of assistance might be, and if other testing candidates will be subjected to that punishment if they, too, run into the gray-haired man. Not sure what else to do, I pour some of the fresh, clean water into the canteen. Then I store the bottle and the sack of food in my bag until I can best work out how to share them with my friends. Back at our camp, I stoke the fire and skin the rabbit while thinking about the gray-haired man and the sack of food he gave to me. Who is he? From my fellow candidates, I've learned that Five Lakes Colony is far better stocked with provisions than many other colonies. So why is the gray-haired man sharing his food and water with an unknown girl? Does he know why I'm on this side of the fence? Does he know there are others out here on the corrupted plains? Does he understand this is a test that some of us will not survive? By the time I get the rabbit roasting and wake my companions, I still have no answers. Will is giddy at the sight of the cooking meat, dancing back and forth on the balls of his feet. He reminds me of my brother Hameen on Christmas Day. It makes me wonder if it's that similarity that causes me to trust him. No one questions the amount of water in the canteen as we eat breakfast, pack up, and walk back to the road. With everyone's stomach full, I feel less guilty about the food hidden deep in my testing bag, but I find myself walking behind them, watching the fence line for signs of the man who gave me the food. After 10 miles, we have yet to spot water, although we do find a tree bearing small, hard apples. We fill our bags with the apples and some wild carrots I find growing nearby, and then we set off again. After another 5 miles, I begin to suspect that any nearby water sources will not be close enough to the road for us to spot. The testers aren't making it that easy. The ground around the road is packed flat, which makes me say, "I think one of us should take a bicycle and scout for water off the road. Whoever goes can cover more territory and get back before it's time to camp for the night." "I'll go," Will volunteers. Tomas immediately rejects the offer. "No offense, Will, but once you have one of the bicycles, who's to say you won't ditch us and speed your way to the finish line?" "You're right, I could do that," Will smiles. His tone is affable, but I can see in his eyes something flat, dark, and angry. I wouldn't, but I can understand how you might not trust my word given the circumstances, even if your girlfriend here does. I'm also guessing you won't trust me to stay with her while you go scouting.
You guessed right.
Tomas's mouth curls into an answering smile. I can't help but notice the way his hands are clenching at his sides.
There's no way I'm leaving Sia alone with anyone, not even you.
Will stops in his tracks. His eyes are cold. His hands ball into fists. So, where does that leave us, Tomas? Before Tomas can respond, I say, It leaves the two of you idiots here sweating out our last drops of water while I go in search of more. If the words come out harsher than I intended, I'm not sorry. Will and Tomas look ready to fight. And while I'm grateful that Tomas wants to keep me safe, this whole macho thing is out of place considering our circumstances. Even with the hidden bottle of water, our chances of survival decrease every mile that we don't find another water source. Taking out the near-empty canteen, I throw it at Tomas and say, I'm going to bike about 10 miles ahead, set a couple of snares, and then go off the road to look for water. I'll leave a marker by the side of the road near the snares in case you get there first. Try to act like the adults you're supposed to be while I'm busy keeping us all alive. If you can't handle that, you both deserve to fail this test, and we all know what punishment that brings. I throw my leg over the bicycle and start pedaling. Tomas shouts for me to wait, but I don't turn back. The two of them will have to work out their differences on their own. The fact that they both have weapons concerns me for a brief moment, but I shove the worry aside and keep pedaling. My anger fades as my wheels propel me farther from my friends. This test is designed to help us learn about the land we need to restore to health, but it also gives us and the testing officials a strong look into our character. Yes, the boys were out of line, but I overreacted. While I'm not proud of it, I've just learned not only that I have a temper, but that I would happily run headfirst into whatever danger I might find alone just to prove a point. Perhaps I have a bit of growing up to do, too. When the transit communicator says I've traveled 10 miles, I tie a piece of sheet to a bush near the side of the road, walk 50 feet beyond it, and set several snares. With that task done, I start pedaling over dirt, grass, and rocks to the northwest in search of water. The sun is hot as I canvass the landscape. The air is thick with moisture. If we're lucky, it will rain. I'm grateful for the secret bottle of water as I zigzag across the cracked earth, and I'm still annoyed enough with both boys that I eat the hunk of cheese and part of the bread for lunch without any guilt. I get off the bicycle and walk while studying the ground for signs of animal tracks. While my fellow testing candidates and I are only passing through, the animals live year-round in this barren stretch of land. They must have a source of water in order to survive. I find what looks like raccoon tracks and follow them west. After about 3 miles, I'm ready to give up, when I see a small dip in the terrain nearly 200 yards to the north. The grass around the dip looks marginally healthier than the brown, crackly stuff I've been traveling over, making my hopes rise as I ride to check it out. And I'm glad I did. The dip I saw is the bank of a shallow stream. A couple of tests, the additions of the right chemicals, and I'm able to fill my water containers. I'm tired but triumphant as I return to my bicycle, consult my compass, and begin the trek back to the road. I'm so pleased with my efforts that I don't register the sound of something moving behind me. When I do, I barely have time to pull my gun free of my bag's side pocket before my bicycle is hit from the side, sending me careening to the ground. Scrambling out from under the bicycle, I see an animal leap, and I roll to the right. Whatever the thing is, it hits the ground with a snarl. Before I can blink, it's up and launching another attack. This time I don't move fast enough. I scream as the creature's claws slash deep into my left arm. Whatever this thing is, I know I can't outrun it. Even if I could get back on my bicycle, it's doubtful I'd be able to outdistance something with such speed. The animal snarls as I roll out of its grasp, push to my feet, and race to put distance between us. I turn and extend the gun in front of me as it barrels toward me. As I aim, I finally get a look at it. Long legs matted in a tangle of brownish hair, long arms that are extended toward me with 3-inch claws I already know are razor sharp, a hunched back, curled lips revealing blackish teeth, more brownish hair on the torso and back, and the eyes. My finger pulls hard on the trigger, and I barely keep my footing as the gun jolts. The eyes of my attacker go wide. There's anger and fear as the wound in its chest blossoms with bright red blood. My enemy sinks to the ground and with its last breath lets out a cry that sounds like a call for help. Which it might be, because now that I have looked into the dark blue eyes of my attacker, I know this isn't an animal. The eyes are too intelligent, too much like the ones I see looking back at me in a reflector. The body was twisted and deformed, but there's no doubt. I just killed a human being. There's no time to deal with the swell of emotions I feel as an answering call sounds from somewhere to my right, near the water I collected, which only makes sense. If I had to pick a spot to make my home in this wasteland, that would be a logical place. My arm is on fire. Blood streams down it, but I don't have time to tend to the injury, not with the guttural sounds of other mutated humans coming closer. Racing to where my bicycle fell, I yank it upright and straddle the seat as 3 more clawed humans appear over the rise. My feet push hard to gain momentum, and I can tell the minute the one I killed is spotted. There's a cry so filled with pain and loss that it makes me blink back tears. Then the cry is replaced by a snarl, and I know they see me and have begun their chase. They're much faster than I am. Whatever chemical reaction warped their bodies and twisted their fingers into claws has also given them incredible speed. They run with their bodies bent at the waist. Their arms hang low to the ground. Their all-too-intelligent eyes are fixated on me. The sight of my 3 attackers closing the space between us is terrifying. Sweat pours down my body, stinging the wound on my arm as I force my legs to pump up the incline. Years of playing games with my older and faster brothers has taught me that the top of the hill will give me the best vantage point from which to defend myself. The closer they come, the louder their snarls. And something else. Something more human. Words. None that I understand, but the sounds are too clear and purposeful for them to be anything else. The 3 are communicating with language and using it to plot their attack, even as I'm plotting mine. The heat, the loss of blood, the exertion to make it up the steep hill all make me dizzy. The world swims in and out of focus as my heart pounds loud and hard in my chest. I know that if I slow up for even a moment, I'll die. That alone keeps me pushing the pedals around and around. I rise up off the seat for the last stretch of hill, using my whole body to propel the bicycle up, up, up. The minute I hit the top, I jump off, let the bicycle clatter to the ground, and spin to take aim. For a moment, my finger stills over the trigger as I watch the three travel up the hill toward me. My throat tightens as I hear them shout guttural words back and forth. I straighten my shoulders and set my aim on the one on the left. The trio is getting closer, only 20 yards away. But still, I don't shoot. I don't want to kill them. They're human. Maybe not the same version of human that I am, but we come from the same ancestry. Everything I've been taught makes me want to find a way to communicate with them, to help them. Instead, I pull the trigger. The one on the left clutches its leg and hits the ground with a yelp. The middle one turns back to look at its fallen comrade, and I fire again. This time I hit the torso, and the second attacker goes down in a heap. The last lets out an anguished cry and lunges up the hill with its teeth bared. I spot the wetness of tears streaming down its face as my bullet enters its skull. The last is dead. The other two have been injured enough to keep them on the ground, but for how long I don't know. Part of me wants to bury the dead one, like I did the testing candidate we found. But there isn't time for that. I need to get away before the other two rise, or more, take their place. Stumbling, I remount the bicycle and pedal away, barely noticing the tears that threaten to blind me. Traveling downhill is easier, but I'm aware of the blood streaming from my wound. I don't look at it for fear of what I'll see. I just keep pedaling and coasting until I spot the road. When I reach it, I can barely stand, let alone pedal. Sitting on the hard, hot surface, I finally fish out the medical kit and strip off my top to assess the damage. The five parallel cuts on my upper arm are jagged but shallow and at least 7 inches long. It's bad, but not as bad as I feared. While the injury hurts, I can still move my arm. None of the muscles or tendons has been cut, and my stomach churns with relief. Some animal scratches can fester if not treated properly. While my attacker was human, I'm careful to clean every inch of the wound and apply lots of anti-infection ointment. The ointment hitting the wound sends blazing pain up and down my arm. My eyes water, my nose runs. I can't wipe either because my one good hand is working at securing a clean bandage around the injury. Once that is done, I struggle into my other shirt. The fabric catches on my identification bracelet, and I vaguely wonder if the people listening were excited to hear the gunshots. Do they think I killed another candidate? Does that raise their opinion of me as a leader? Do they understand that I'm injured? Do they even care? My entire body wants nothing more than to stay seated, but I slowly rise to my feet, store my testing bag on the bicycle, and check my transit communicator. I've traveled more than 45 miles today. Will and Tomas are somewhere on the road to the east, and they need the water I've found. Knowing their survival depends on me makes me move the pedals round and round. And if I'm totally honest with myself, my reasons for backtracking are much less noble. I'm scared to be alone, scared to face the things that might come in the dark, scared to face my own conscience after taking human life. But I might not have a choice. My legs are sluggish as the sunlight fades. I eat the rest of the bread and some of the raisins, sip water, and check the transit communicator again, trying to decide how long it'll take to reach Will and Tomas. If they stopped to search for water or food, they might be miles away, too far for me to reach before the sky turns black. My muscles are heavy as I scan the sides of the road, looking for a place to camp. Something that's defensible but still has a good view of the road, just in case Tomas and Will keep walking after dark. After another 2 miles, I see a clump of trees, oak or maybe elm, near the fence line about 70 yards off the road. I tie a piece of the white sheet from the cot to a branch and stick it into the ground as a marker. If Tomas and Will see it, they'll know I'm nearby. The leaves on the trees are a yellowish brown, but the trunks and branches look sound. While I might sleep more comfortably on the ground, I decide to climb the sturdiest looking of the trees and hope to find a place to camp in the branches. Of course, much depends on whether my left arm is strong enough. I stash my bicycle in some tall brown grass and decide to try. As I jump to catch a low-hanging limb, my left arm sings with pain. I bite my lip to keep from crying out, but I don't let go. Instead, I grit my teeth, pull myself up, and climb the way my brothers taught me. The tree I've chosen is thick with heavy branches. I find a spot where several limbs are close together and perch with my back up against the trunk. Not the most comfortable bed I've ever had, but one I'm fairly certain I won't fall out of if I manage to sleep tonight. The moon comes out. I yearn for my mother's hands stroking my hair through the night the way she did whenever I was sick. Thinking of home, I keep my eyes fastened to the road in case Tomas and Will are still traveling. But somewhere during the course of my watch, I fall fast asleep. Hands reach for me, slash my arm. Instead of screaming unintelligible words, the person I shoot calls me by name. Tears stream from its intelligent eyes as it begs me to take pity. But I don't. I shoot and kill again and again. I jolt awake, my face wet with tears. My heart slows as I realize I'm not on the hill. There are no eyes filled with pain accusing me with their dying stares. I'm alone. The moon is still shining, but I can tell by the haze of gray in the sky that daylight will not be far behind. Squinting toward the road, I see my makeshift flag still standing on the sidelines. Tomas and Will are nowhere in sight. My injured arm protests as I shift around on my branch, preparing to descend. It screams the minute my boots make contact with the ground. I swallow several more pills before once more cleaning the cuts. The wounds don't look any worse than yesterday, which makes me feel a bit better as I apply more ointment and struggle to rewrap the bandage. A thud on the ground behind me makes my heart stop, and I leap to my feet with my gun held firm in my hand. I turn my head back and forth, looking for the source of the noise, and find it. On the ground near the fence is another coarse brown bag, identical to the one given to me yesterday. This time I don't hesitate before opening it. Water, 2 apples, another loaf of bread and cheese, and what looks like a piece of roasted chicken. No note, no sign of my benefactor, just the food and the water, and the hope they provide. Breakfast consists of chicken and an apple. I feel better after the meal, and after shoving the rest into the bottom of my bag, I break camp. The pain pills take the edge off the agony of the wound. My arm is still sore, but the pain is manageable. Pulling my marker from the side of the road, I climb onto my bicycle and set off to the east in search of my friends. I find them 2 miles down the road, looking tired but alive. I can tell the minute Tomas spots me. Even at this distance, I see his face light up. My heart swells with love as I race down the road, dismount my bicycle, and throw myself into his waiting arms. His mouth finds mine, and for a minute I forget that Will is standing next to us. I abandon myself to feeling alive and in love. When I do remember, I walk over to Will, give him a kiss on the cheek, and hand him a canteen filled with water. "See, Tomas, I told you that she was fine and that she'd find water." He takes several swallows from the canteen and flashes a smile. "Your snares also worked like a charm. Two squirrels and some kind of mutated fox. Too bad your snares couldn't land me some wheels, but those are the breaks, right?"
"I've been thinking about that,"
I say as Tomas notices the bandage peeping out from under my shirt.
"What happened?"
Gently, he takes my arm and pulls the shirt sleeve up to reveal the entire length of bandage.
"Are you okay?"
"I'm fine," I say. Turns out I wasn't the only one who was interested in using the water source I found. Without going into a lot of detail, I give them a rundown on my injury and escape from the stream. Tomas asks a couple of questions, which I answer as briefly as I can. At no time do I mention the attack was perpetrated by another kind of human, and I completely eliminate the trio of humans who lay chase after I killed their friend. To do so would open myself up to questions I don't want to answer, especially not with testing officials listening in. Once I'm done, I ask them about their travel. From the look Tomas and Will exchange, it's clear something went wrong.
"What? Did you run into trouble too? I was worried you wouldn't have enough water to get you through the day."
Tomas looks away as Will says, "The two of us shouted a lot after you left. We might have even thrown a punch or two. Then we decided to put aside our differences and get moving. About lunchtime, we ran out of water. We also ran into another testing candidate."
"Who?"
I ask, looking down the road. My heart quickens. "Anyone we know?" Will shakes his head.
"A guy from Colorado Springs Colony. He wasn't exactly thrilled to see us, but he wasn't all bad. Right, Tomas? He did share his water."
Tomas just shrugs.
"Where did he go?"
I'm not surprised that Tomas wasn't willing to let another testing candidate travel with them, but now there's someone trailing behind us who knows we're here. Not having met the person or sized up his intentions, I can't help my anxiety. Will takes another slug of water and frowns. "I tried to get Tomas here to agree to let the kid join us, but he wasn't inclined to trust anyone else. We left him about 15 miles back. He was looking pretty tired. I think he planned on resting for a while. I don't think he'll catch up to us anytime soon." The strain in Will's smile, the way Tomas won't meet my eyes, both speak to what my gut has already told me. Something is very wrong. My next questions are met with short, vague answers, and I'm left wondering what secrets Tomas's and Will's silences are hiding. I hand a water bottle to Tomas and store the empty canteen Will gives me in my bag. Then we set off down the road. Will tells us he'll understand if we want to ride, but I suggest we stick together for a while longer. After my run-in with the local inhabitants yesterday, I'm glad for the protection both Tomas and Will provide. Late in the afternoon, we spot a cluster of buildings in the distance to our right, possibly what is left of a small town.
"Well, that's my cue,"
Will says with a quick grin. "If I can find something with wheels, I'll catch up to you guys by tomorrow night. If not, well, I'll see you at the finish line, okay?" Tomas tells Will to be careful and mounts his bicycle. His smile gives no doubt as to his feelings. Tomas is happy to see Will go. Will hands me half of the roasted meat from last night and then gives me a hug goodbye. While his arms are wrapped tight around me, he whispers,
"Watch your back, Sia. Your boyfriend isn't the nice guy he's pretending to be. I'll try to join you soon. Until then, be very careful."
I want to ask what he means, what he saw, what he and Tomas did that has put shadows in both their eyes. But I can't because Will is loping away from the road toward the buildings far in the distance. Whatever secrets are being kept, I'll have to figure out for myself. Tomas isn't in the mood to talk as we glide to the southwest. The fast pace he sets tells me he's attempting to put as much distance between us and Will as he can. Or maybe he's trying to put distance between himself and whatever happened when the two were alone. I have to work hard to keep up with Tomas and often lag behind. My arm is throbbing and my entire body cries out for rest. But I don't stop until the sky turns from bright blue to gray. As I unpack the roasted meat, Tomas says,
"The moon's been brighter the last couple of nights. We probably can ride a little farther if you're up to it."
"Why? I mean, I want to get to the end of this test as fast as we can, but you're acting like something is chasing us." A flash of twisted claws enters my mind. I shake it free and ask, "What happened while I was gone?"
"Nothing."
Tomas shrugs.
"Look, we lost a lot of time in that city maze, and who knows what other things the testers have arranged to slow us down. I figure we should travel fast while we can."
The point is valid, but his light tone is contradicted by the tightness of his jaw and the hands clenching and unclenching at his side. And that's when I see it. A smear of brown on the hilt of his knife. Dried blood. My insides churn as I think about the testing candidate they ran into. The questions Tomas won't answer. Will's warning about Tomas not being exactly what he seems. I shake loose the rising fear, telling myself I've known Tomas for years. He's kind and caring. The blood is probably from cleaning the snared animals. And even if it isn't, there are other justifiable reasons for the stain. I should know after what I've done. I should just ask Tomas and set the worry aside. But I don't. I eat my meat and clover, drink some water, and remount my bicycle so we can pedal another 5 miles before we rest. When we do make camp, Tomas insists on one of us keeping watch. After what I've seen roaming the plain, I don't object. He takes first watch and stands next to a tree. In the moonlight, I can see him brushing aside tears. While my first instinct is to go to him, I know he thinks that I'm asleep, that his grief is his own. My heart aches that he won't share his pain and the source of it with me. Although, how can I object? I have secrets too. Secrets that make me fight sleep. And when sleep pulls me under, those secrets chase me in my dreams. Tomas shakes me awake from a dream filled with gunshots and bloody knives. He gives me a kiss and asks if I'm okay. I'm not, but I smile and tell him my dream was no big deal. More secrets. Since I'm awake, I tell him to get some rest while I keep watch. I sit next to the same tree he chose, but instead of watching the road, I set my eyes firmly on the fence line as I wait to see if anyone appears. No one does. The day dawns. We mount our bicycles and begin to pedal. Despite Tomas getting several hours of sleep, his eyes look red and tired. He brushes my attempts at conversation aside, and when he does speak, it's only to worry about our lack of food and water. I do my best to stay optimistic as a bridge comes into sight. Beyond the high arching road lies another city. My mouth goes dry with fear. Another test? The bridge climbs over land for several miles before stretching over a wide river. From far above, the water looks cleaner than any we've seen in the testing area. This river must have been purified by a colony north of here. Unfortunately, the bridge we take to cross the river keeps the water tantalizingly out of reach. The only way to reach the water safely is to travel back several miles to where the bridge began. Perhaps that is part of this test, to see if we'll recognize that getting the water takes more effort than finding another source. Then again, a desperate candidate might not care. I'm thankful we're not that desperate. We're rewarded at the end of the bridge with a less than sparkling, but according to my tests, drinkable pond. In the distance, perhaps 2 or 3 miles, looms the city. After the last trek through city streets, we're acutely aware of our diminished supplies. Even with my secret stash of food, we could not survive for more than a few days. As much as Tomas wants to race away from whatever he left behind, he says, "Why don't we camp here for the night? We can wash and maybe catch some game before we start into the city." I'm quick to agree. Leaving Tomas to fill and treat the water bottles, I head off to the southwest to set snares and look for other fresh foods. There's a small wooded spot several hundred yards away where I set snares and begin my search for roots and greens. I'm digging up some wild carrots when I spot movement in the wooded area beyond the testing fence. The man with gray hair appears from behind a tall bush. He approaches the fence and beckons me. Without a second thought, I dump my bag on a tree stump and remove my identification bracelet. I place it on top of the bag and then walk the 50 yards to the fence to meet whatever fate has in store. Chapter 17. I don't bother to take my weapon. If this person wanted me dead, he could have killed me days ago. The man's gray hair gives the appearance of age, but his eyes and the lack of lines on his face tell me he's years younger than I first guessed. He's wearing a gray sleeveless shirt, which shows off strong arms and brown loose-fitting pants. In his hand is a bag much like the ones that he's tossed over the fence to me. Pushing my hair out of my face, I say, "Thanks for the food." The man smiles. "You're more than welcome." I wait for him to continue, but the silence stretches between us. Jamming my hands in my pockets, I ask, "Who are you?" "I'm a friend who wants to see you survive this journey. My name isn't all that important." Maybe not to him. His unwillingness to share it with me sets me on edge. "Well, thanks again for the food." I turn on my heel to leave and hear, "If you wait, I'll explain why I can't tell you my name and why I want to help you." My feet stand still. I look at him and wait. "My name will mean nothing to you, but it might mean something to those who evaluate your performance when this test is complete. And while I trust you would not willingly share my name with the testing officials, you might not have a choice."
"Why?"
"They told you about the interview after the fourth test?" He waits for me to nod. "Before the interview begins, they'll give you a drug to encourage you to answer the questions honestly, without holding back anything you wish to keep secret." While there are things I've done during this test I would rather not talk about, nothing I've experienced thus far would cause me difficulty if I'm forced to speak. My ability to remove the bracelets might cause the testers concern, but wouldn't they see that as a sign of my resourcefulness? Even this strange man and his gifts of food are not dangerous to me. Dr. Barnes stated we could not leave the testing grounds. Nowhere in the rules did he mention not accepting food thrown over the fence. Straightening my shoulders, I say, I have nothing to hide.
Are you sure of that, Sia?
The sound of my name on this unknown man's lips makes my heart clench. I'd assumed my encounters with this man were random. The fact that he knows who I am suggests something entirely different. How do you know who I am? Are you a testing official? He laughs. Far from it. I'm someone who believes the testing process is wrong and wants to help you survive. Not just to the end of this test, but through the challenges the university will bring. Up until now, my goal has been to survive the testing in order to make it to the safety of the university. The idea that the university might be filled with more tests sends a chill straight to my heart. But while questions about the potential dangers of the university spring to my lips, I know this isn't the time to ask them. I'll worry about that if and when the time comes. Instead, I ask something equally, if not more, important. If you're against the testing, why are you throwing us food and water? Why not help us escape? As I believe the esteemed Dr. Barnes explained, testing candidates can't leave the testing ground. The fences are harmless enough until a testing candidate goes over them. The man reaches into his pants pocket and pulls a silver identification bracelet from his pocket. The symbol is a triangle with what looks like a drawing of a human eye at the center. A memory nags at me from after the third test. Tomas pointing out the students in his group. A boy with a shock of untamed brown hair and a sweet smile. The boy scaled the fence about 100 miles back. He was dead by the time he hit the ground. The only thing we could do was bury him, the way you and your friend buried the girl candidate you found. My muscles go still. Only a testing official could know Tomas and I did that. Not all testing officials agree with the current procedures. One even disabled several skimmers in an effort to keep officials from arriving at their designated colonies in time to pick up candidates for the testing. Unfortunately, the part we had him disable was not as difficult to repair as intelligence led us to believe. Otherwise, you'd still be in Five Lakes Colony, and I'd be having this discussion with a different candidate. Was he talking about Michael? Is he the one who told this gray-haired man about me? Something tells me asking will not get me the answer. This man is here for a purpose. I've already been away from the testing official's listening device for too long. Too much longer, and they might question my stillness. It's time to learn what this man's purpose is. Why are we having this discussion? For the first time, he smiles. Because, Sia, we know your family has secrets you don't want the Commonwealth to know. The bag he's been holding comes sailing over the fence. Inside that bag is a small vial. It contains a liquid that we believe will counteract the interview drug. Take it the morning of the interview if you want to keep you and your family safe. The tacit threat to my family scares me to the core. But fear won't help me. I tamp it down. I look at the bag in my hand, and then back at him. How do I know this isn't another test? If it is, the liquid in the vial will probably kill me. Punishment for a wrong answer.
You don't.
There's sadness in his voice.
You've only my word that I'm not part of the United Commonwealth.
He takes a step back from the fence.
Hide the vial in your spare clothing before you cross the finish line. One of my friends will make sure it isn't discovered by the testing officials and is safely hidden in your possessions again before the interview begins. Good luck, Malencia. I hope we meet again.
Without another word, he turns and walks away. I watch until he disappears into the tall grass before retrieving my identification bracelet and my testing bag. The sun is starting to set. I need to get back to Tomas, but I take a moment to think over everything I heard as I empty the brown bag. Yes, there's a small, unmarked vial corked with a black stopper. Carefully, I unwork the stopper and take a sniff. It smells faintly of roses. I shove the vial deep into my pants pocket and look at the other items. More water. Instead of bread and cheese, I find a small container of raspberries, a heaping bundle of wild carrots, and several small yellowish fruits that I think are pears. The wild carrots and raspberries are plants I might find here in this area. I wonder if the pears are as well. I move away from the fence, and after a 15-minute search, I find not only a pear tree, but also a thick bush ripe with raspberries, along with several spots wherein an abundance of wild carrots grow. The bag isn't food just for me. It's food to be shared. The man beyond the fence must also know I never told Tomas about the bread and cheese. The man knows a great deal. He implied he also knows my family's secrets. Was he talking about my father's nightmares? Or that Zine is smarter than all of us, and that knowledge was hidden from Dr. Barnes and his testing officials? That leaders of Five Lakes conspired to keep their graduating students safe? Knowing there's a chance I might be asked about those things in my interview makes me break out in a cold sweat. Or maybe this is all just another test. Maybe the man is trying to scare me into drinking the liquid in the vial and failing. This is a problem I'll have to address at some point, but not now. Arms filled with supplies, I trek back to camp and wait for Tomas's reaction to the bounty. I'm not disappointed as he helps me put the food on the ground and then picks me up and swings me around. The shadows of the past 2 days disappear, and it feels like we're back home in Five Lakes, safe and happy and whole. We eat the last of the roasted meat and fill our stomachs with juicy raspberries and pears. We plan to collect more tomorrow before heading into the city. I check Tomas's backside, which seems much improved, and my own arm, which doesn't look so good and hurts like hell. I wash the wound clean in the pond, swallow a couple of pain pills to ward off the worst of the sting, and slather on more ointment, knowing deep down that it won't do much good. But I have to try, right? Tomas helps me rewrap my bandage, teases me about the berry stains on my mouth, and kisses them away. He is so like his old self that I find myself yearning to tell him my secrets. But I can't. Not yet. First, I need to know, what happened with you and Will after I left?
Will told you what happened.
A lot more happened than either of you mentioned. I feel Tomas stiffen.
Are you calling me a liar?
No, I assure him, but I know you and Will weren't exactly getting along when I rode off. Tomas moves his arm from around my shoulders, gets to his feet, and stares into the distance, doing his best to shut me out, which hurts. I scramble to my feet and touch his shoulder. Look, I know it's hard to trust someone under these circumstances, but I trust Will.
You shouldn't.
Tomas's eyes meet mine with blazing passion.
Didn't your father warn you not to trust anyone?
Tomas's words stop my heart.
He knows that someone is listening, and that if by luck they hadn't been paying attention to our conversation before we reached Tosu City, then not taking care with his words now might put my father, my whole family, in jeopardy.
Swallowing hard, I say, I trust you, and my father warned me that competition might blind some people, but that doesn't mean Will is one of them.
How can you be so sure? Because he makes jokes and was upset when his brother didn't make it through the first round? So what? You don't know what he's capable of. When we found your snares, he unpacked his bag to look for his knife. In the bag, he also had a purification kit, a medical bag, a pair of binoculars, and a map book like mine.
And?
The numbers don't add up. We were allowed to choose three items. Three that we could add to two personal items. The knife, the gun. Add them to the others.
I do the math. Maybe he found the knife or binoculars along the way.
They both have testing logos etched into them, just like your gun, my knife, which means he ran into at least one testing candidate.
The girl we buried flashes in front of me. I shake the image away.
Maybe a candidate lost their bag or he saw one asleep and decided to take their things.
Not exactly an admirable choice, but one I can almost live with.
Look, people do strange things under pressure. Just because he had a few extra possessions doesn't mean he hurt whoever he came across. The two of you met a candidate while I was gone and nothing happened to him, right?
Yeah.
Tomas drops his gaze and says,
right.
With all my heart, I want to believe him, but I'm not sure I do. Tomas, who from my earliest memories has always been calm and collected, is filled with tension and anger and despair. Trying to sound upbeat, I add,
I know you don't trust Will, but I want you to consider that there might be another explanation. The United Commonwealth is looking for a new generation of leaders. Even leaders have to trust sometime.
My tone, if not my words, seems to calm Tomas, and we settle back onto the ground to prepare for sleep. Tomas's arm wrapped around me, my head resting against his chest.
But there's one question I have to ask before closing my eyes. One test I need Tomas to pass. What was the other candidate's name?
I feel Tomas's heart quicken under my cheek, his muscles tense. After a few moments, he whispers,
I don't think he said. If he did, I don't remember.
He's lying. He would have asked for a name. He would have given his own in return. Habit, common decency, the Five Lakes way. My stomach clenches with disappointment, and I fight the urge to retreat from his arms. It's not surprising that both of us only pretend to sleep. The snares are successful, two rabbits and an opossum. While Tomas cleans and sets the game over a fire to roast, I gather more fruit and greens for our journey into the city. There are no morning kisses or gentle looks. Tomas is withdrawn as we pack up camp and begin to ride, which gives me lots of time to think. The sky is overcast. My eyes drift more than once to the fence line as I look for signs of my mysterious benefactor. I'm not surprised when I don't see him, but I do believe he or someone he knows is watching.
Rebels?
He spoke of not being a member of the United Commonwealth, of not agreeing with its methods of testing.
and yet he chose only to offer food and a vial of an unknown drug. Other than the friend who will keep the drug hidden, there's no offer of further assistance, no offer of escape. If he and the people like him could sabotage United Commonwealth skimmers, surely they could find a way to circumvent the penalty for escaping the test. Of course, according to the man, my presence here is proof of their inability to beat the testing officials. Still, even knowing the odds were against success, I believe there are candidates who are sufficiently scared, hungry, or ill, and would leap at the chance to flee. Or would they? We all left families back home, families bound by the laws of the United Commonwealth. The government compensates our families when we leave for the testing. I wonder if the law states what would happen to a family whose testing candidate chose to escape. A large metal arch towers over us as we follow the main road that travels around the outer rim of the city. The buildings stand taller than those in the city we passed through days ago, but these look to be in far worse shape. The scorched nature of some of the wreckage tells the story. This city was bombed. According to Tomas's map book, the name of the city was St. Louis. Neither of us remembers if our history books say what kind of bomb was used here. Some bombs destroyed what was in their path. Others laid waste to water and soil. The worst contained poisons with potencies that, unless physically counteracted, don't fade over time. It's the last option that keeps our bicycles pointed to the west and our eyes fastened on the road that veers around the city. With the sufficient amount of water and food, we don't need to risk whatever tests this city contains. The next few days we settle into a pattern of foraging for food, traveling, and camping. We find several small streams that help us wash away the stains of travel, and while we don't go hungry, our clothes begin to hang from our bodies. I wrap a long piece of cot sheet around the top of my pants to keep them from slipping onto my hips. Tomas is forced to do the same. We talk of only the most superficial things. Every once in a while, I catch Tomas staring at me as though longing to say something. But he doesn't, and neither do I. I jump at every sound, even though there are no more animal attacks or strange humans, although twice we spot what look like other testing candidates on the northern horizon. We pedal faster to avoid confrontation. The man from the other side of the fence doesn't appear again. Just day after day of travel. The shadows beneath Tomas's eyes get heavier. While he laughs and smiles, I can see the strain under everything. My nightmares get worse. Friends, family, and foes find me in my dreams. But I'm learning to bite back the screams that come with waking. I find myself touching the vial of liquid in my pocket to calm myself. More disturbing are the cuts on my arm. For the first few days, I tell myself I'm imagining the difference, but after a week passes, no amount of wishful thinking can change what is undeniable. The cuts have gotten worse. The scabs growing over them turn green and ooze a yellowish liquid. Whatever chemicals twisted the humans in this area have now infected me. I take more pain pills, drink more water, and hope I can make it to the end of this test without the infection doing permanent damage. After more than a week of riding, we spot another large collection of buildings on the horizon. Here, both the northern and southern fence lines are visible. The testers are limiting the amount of space during these last 200 miles. If there are other testing candidates nearby, we're almost certain to come in contact with them. Footprints and what